You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. Today, we are diving right into a frosted highball glass to talk cocktails with the guy that you would most love to bump into at a bar. I'm joined today by David Wondrich, famed cocktail expert and enthusiast, and while sadly I don't have a drink in hand, I am so excited to talk about his recent publication, The Comic Book History of the Cocktail, 5 Centuries of Mixing Drinks and Carrying On. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chelsea. Very happy to be here.
So to start off, you've written extensively and prolifically on the subject, but I have to ask, how many drinks had you had when you came up with the idea of turning this information into a comic book?
Probably a few, because it's been in my to-do project file for a very long time. Maybe not this exact book, but something very much like it.
Oh, that's a good idea. So you actually kind of envisioned the history to tell the history in this way, illustrated.
Yeah, I thought I keep a file, you know, like most writers do, I suppose, of future projects, most of which never turn into anything. And this was in my future projects file, and I was talking to the people at 10 Speed Press, and they asked me if I would be interested in doing a comic book history of the cocktail. And I immediately thought of my file, and I took some of the characters out of that and put it in here. Yeah, I was very happy to do it. I had just finished doing the Oxford Companion to Spirits and Cocktails, which was a big encyclopedia, and that nearly broke my brain. So I wanted something different.
Yeah.
And this is different.
And also a way to kind of get across a lot of that information, but maybe in a more lighthearted, you know, I guess, presentation.
Well, yeah. And also, for me, I've been writing about some of the people I talk about in this book. It's all about, you know, people. There's a lot of different characters in here. And I've been writing about them for some as long as 25 years. But most of them, there are no pictures that exist of them or hardly any. And this was a chance to flesh them out and to bring them before our eyes, to involve another sense.
Yeah.
So you don't have to just imagine them.
Yeah, and I got that sense too, like how much you're able to humanize these early players in this world. But how did you go about researching this book? So you've been making these files for a long time, but there's no old-timey Instagram pics of 17th century cocktails. And, you know, speaking of humanizing folks, you have a section where you have some 19th century bartenders that are folks that took the mint julep and ran with it. So how did you find these stories and these profiles?
Oh, just it's like searching the house for lost jigsaw puzzle pieces. You know, I'm basically looking under sofa cushions and all kinds of things like that. I'm looking in autobiographies, travel books, people's letters, newspapers. There's so much stuff in newspapers. And now we can search them digitally, which means you can actually use these resources, because before digital, you could probably on microfilm read about 4 issues of a newspaper in a day. Because, you know, the things about cocktails aren't in headlines on page one. They're buried in column 4 on page 8 and near the bottom. And so it's really complicated research. And fortunately, I've been doing it for a long time and I know where to look for hidden gold. And sometimes I find it. So I'm very happy about that.
So I'm an archaeologist. When I was reading this book, I remembered giving a presentation at an archaeological conference where I had a picture of an old-timey bartender, and I was like, what was that site? And I went back and I looked at my files, and I remembered we did a dig in Southern Oregon that was the Hotel Central Point, and it was owned by a character named Fred Fredenberg, who created a saloon and dance hall, and he had a black bear as part of his menagerie.
But awesome.
But I went back to my notes, and there was some articles in the newspaper from 1890 that noted that he had hired W.P. Parson, the genial mixologist, who proved quite successful at giving the best satisfaction to his drinking customers. So I was like, oh my gosh, we did archaeology of cocktails, and I need to go back now and look to see if we might have uncovered something. But maybe W.P. Parson can be in version 2 when you have second edition of the comic.
I look forward to finding out more about about him, I've got to say.
Especially you know, if there's a black bear in the picture.
Yeah. Well, Jerry Thomas, the guy who wrote the first Bartender's book, and I've written about him at great length, like a whole book about him, basically. But in here, unfortunately, we didn't illustrate him with the pair of pet white rats he kept on his shoulders while he tended bar that frolicked around and climbed onto his bowler hat and, you know, just basically entertained themselves while he was mixing drinks.
So, So bartenders had like a signature pet that was like probably part of their razzle dazzle, I guess, at the time, huh?
Well, some of them did. You know, this was by the 1890s. Your guy was kind of out of date. That was considered corny and old fashioned to be so flashy and fun.
Well, we are in rural Oregon, so we're always a little bit behind everywhere else.
Yeah, well, sometimes that's good because if, you know, I'd rather have flashy, fun bartenders than a bunch of stiffs looking down their nose at you because you ordered something wrong.
And speaking about being out of date by 1890s, I mean, I was really surprised to read that the first cocktail book, I think it was the 1860s. And before that, it was just kind of vernacular traditions or riffs, or people might have known the names, but not really how to make it. So what did this really mean for like the cocktail movement as becoming kind of a more stable, predictable thing across the U.S.?
Once you get it in print and you have a set of recipes, Jerry Thomas's book came out in 1862. It sold very widely. He didn't make royalties on it. It was work for hire, unfortunately, because later in life he could have used the money. But it came out and it was immediately plagiarized very widely. And what he did with that book is he kind of set the agenda. He sifted through this mass of drinks that had been floating around, passed from bartender to bartender. And he threw out half of them or threw out the silly names that they'd been given and just came up, you know, used the most basic names for them. And he basically set the categories for drinks that many of those categories are still ones we use today. And it was really kind of phenomenal. His competitors, you look at their books that came after, and they're never organized. The drinks are all just kind of shoveled in. Jerry broke them down into families and, you know, said this one, you make it like that, but with this ingredient substituted, and just all kinds of common sense stuff like that.
Wow. You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we are talking about the colorful and delicious history of cocktails. So that's really like a dividing line, like pre-1860 and after 1860 in the cocktail world, because now you have more like named things and
exactly.
Yeah. So, and you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, again, coming back to archaeology, archaeologists have been looking at beer. There's some ancient beer from China that they've tried to recreate. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about some of the stuff I've encountered over the years, material culture wise, like heavy stoneware gin bottles that traveled all the way from Amsterdam to remote Oregon mining camps, you know, on wagons and donkeys. And we found an absinthe bottle in the household of our local famed Swiss pioneer photographer. And there was an apple brandy distilled by one of our earliest female brewers. So we're finding alcohol, but not really the art form of mixing it and making it fancy. So, you know.
Well, it doesn't, you know, a lot of that stuff doesn't lend itself to archaeology as much because it's a performance. Your ingredients you'll find, and I love that you found Holland gin. That's what we drank in America. We didn't drink English gin. You know, that was a Johnny come lately. Part of America was settled by the Dutch, and that's the people that taught us to drink gin.
Ah.
So we had a long prejudice. Only in the 1880s did London-style gins move into focus and start taking off. And Holland gin outsold English gin up until 1897, something like that.
Wow.
Only then did it take over. So yeah, gin meant something very different to Americans than what we think of today. And a lot of that is, you know, a lot of the archaeology of mixology is stuff like that, is knowing what the ingredients were and knowing what the software was. There's not a lot of hardware. I collect antique bar gear, and some of the earliest stuff is so flimsy that it would not last buried anywhere, or, you know, if a place burned, it would burn up. It would just melt into a little puddle. It wouldn't survive a fire.
Yeah, I was wondering when jiggers and shakers come into the scene.
No, pretty early on, surprisingly early. By the 1850s, you've got shakers.
Oh, and my gosh.
Jiggers by the 1860s. And the basic set of bar tools is pretty much unchanged, at least except for small details, for the past 150 years at least.
Okay, when I find a jigger in an archaeological site, you're the first person I call.
Yeah, please do. I would be curious to see it.
Yeah, so, you know, again, with the patent medicine era, there were a lot of medicines that were really just an excuse to drink alcohol. And I'm thinking Jamaican ginger, which was like, I saw one label was like over 90% alcohol and probably mixed nicely with whiskey. But there's a lot of cocktail components even today that probably got their start in the world of medicine. And I'm thinking like bitters is basically like a tincture. Like how did...
Exactly.
Yeah. So how did bitters become so, you know, less of something you took at night to calm your stomach and more of something that you put a little drop on a Manhattan?
Well, the guy who invented bitters as we know it was a London apothecary, Richard Stoughton. And as early as 1690, he had the bright idea to make an alcoholized extract of the bitter herbs that people usually steeped in beer or wine for a couple weeks to make a bitter beer or wine as a stomach tonic. And he said, well, you know, let me do something quick. So he used spirits and made it very concentrated so you could put a spoonful in your beer or wine or, as he advertised very quickly, brandy. And that would give you all the benefit of the steeped stuff. So he started doing this like very early, and very early on in his ads, which were frequent, he mentioned that this stuff right at the top of the ad, he would put in, it had a pleasant though bitterish taste. And so he was already looking at, you know, consumers taking it off prescription, let's say.
Yeah, more recreationally.
Yeah, exactly. And he tells people that they could put it in brandy, which was usually sold sweetened at that time. And that gives you a cocktail. A cocktail is bitters, sugar, and spirits.
Yeah.
And, you know, a little dilution. And so he was already the mixological foundations, to use a term of the art, of the cocktail were already in place by 1700 in London.
Wow. And I want to talk a little bit more about mixers, too. I had a misguided teen adventure where I did shots from a bottle of vermouth I found in my mom's fridge, which was disgusting. And I now know to add a healthy dose of gin. But in Spain, there are vermouth bars. And in Rome, Rome, I was telling some friends that I like to add Amaro to a Manhattan, and they were like shocked and gasped. It was blasphemy. So a lot of things that we think about as mixers have lives of their own around the world. So how did they get relegated to the sidekicks over here? Do we just not have sophisticated enough palates?
We didn't need them in their original roles. We had our own things. We had all kinds of bitters. So we didn't need Amari to come in from Italy and take the place of our bitters. We just fit them into our framework, you know. And that's what happened with a lot of stuff, like spirits. We drank a lot of spirits in the New World, partly because wine struggled here because of phylloxera and various other reasons. Beer was too heavy to transport, and we just didn't have the roads or the population centers to make beer really economical, other than in the big cities. So out in the backcountry, it was all spirits because that's what you could transport, and that's how you could transport your crops. You could distill them down into something. So our drinking culture kind of grew differently, and by the time America was rich enough to start importing fancy booze from all over the world, we already had a system, and we plugged the stuff right into it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And we do find like brandy and liquor bottles all over the place. So they were more efficient than beer that would maybe need to be fresher and stuff. So I have so much more to ask you, but we're going to take a quick break and we will be back with more Underground History. And we're back. You're listening to Underground History. I'm Chelsea Rose, and today we are talking about 500 years of mixing drinks and carrying on. So, you know, in your book, you talk a lot about punch houses of the 17th century, which traveled with the East India Company over to London and how local customs would have mm-hmm. probably helped create this specific type of drink, but maybe it was also for diluting. And I was wondering if that, like, to add punch or, like, some of these early cocktails, is it a way just to make really inconsistent and bad alcohol taste better?
That's what people always say, but, you know, we can't taste the spirits they were drinking in the 17th century, unfortunately. Those bottles don't survive. I hesitate to make that judgment because I think they probably tasted bad, but we don't know. You know, there are always good people making things.
Yeah, so, that's true. That's true.
You know, there might have been people making perfectly delicious stuff. But punch was a way of making artificial wine. It was the first mixed drink to get widely popular based on distilled spirits, not counting just fortified wine where you pour spirits into wine, or pop-in where you dump a shot glass of spirits into your beer. But the first real, you know, mixed drink was punch, and that was citrus, sugar, water, and spirits. And with the citrus, you're restoring some of the acidity from wine, with the and some of the fruitiness. With the sugar, you're restoring the sweetness. With the water, you're lowering the proof to wine proof. And it was a way for sailors and East India Company merchants who spread it. I don't know if they invented it. It could have been a native invention in India where it first appears, but they certainly spread it to the world. And because you could ship spirits, you could put spirits on board your ships and they wouldn't go bad. And then you could stop at ports of call and get lemons fresh everywhere. Everywhere in the tropics anyway. And and sugar keeps, you know, that's practically inert if you can keep the rats out of it.
Yeah.
So they had a way of basically reconstituting their own wine whenever they wanted it, which was several times a day, it seems like.
And, you know, punch seems so central to the cocktail journey, but in the U.S., it's like, it's not something you really think about. Like, I guess I've never been to a thrift store without seeing at least one punch bowl, but, you know, the crystal one with all the cups.
Right.
But I just, like, think about it as, like, you know, overly sweet, non-alcoholic drink that you have to, like, fish. I mean, it doesn't even appeal to me. So when did the good old boozy punch die out to be replaced with, like, Kool-Aid and, like, the really sugar, just, like, for high school prom kind of stuff?
Well, it came with the temperance movement, a switch to temperance punches. And, you know, in some parts of the country, that temperance movement was very strong already by the 1870s. And that's when you start to see punch dying out as a great social drink with booze in it, which was its history. But they was like, well, let's just leave the booze out and we'll put some citrus in or some pineapple juice.
It's the first mocktail.
Exactly. and you know, it's Gresham's law. Good money drives out bad.
Yeah.
I mean, bad money drives out good.
Yeah. Rather. Yeah.
But by, you know, once Prohibition rolls around, the art of punch making is kind of forgotten, except for among several social clubs and places like the Upper Midwest where they keep all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But in general, it was a lost art, and people have been bringing it back over the last two decades, thank God.
Yeah.
Because it's a great social thing.
It still has something left to
punch.
Offer.
Yeah. Yeah, it has so much left to offer. You put out a bowl of good punch, like made properly, you know, kind of the old style. And people gather around it, you know, the first one or two of them, and then other people, and you let people ladle it out themselves, and they go back and they go back. You make sure it's not too strong so they don't all fall over. And as the ice melts, it dilutes it, which is good.
Yeah.
And it becomes like this social ritual where people are pouring glasses for each other and strangers are meeting strangers, and you're two different groups of friends who really don't know each other suddenly know each other.
Well, there are all those punch bowls out there in Goodwills around the nation just waiting to be rediscovered. So
yeah, I left a couple of them still. Yeah. I have probably three of them. So
you're still ready for your punch party.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, speaking with David Wondrich. He is the foremost authority on one of my favorite subjects, which is cocktails. So I want to get into a little bit how much cocktail history is interwoven with colonialism and capitalism and global violence. And in your comic, you talk about enslaved workers in rum factories and the black men who perfected mm-hmm. the julep being reduced from craftsmen to tray carriers and women that were displaced and replaced by men behind the bar. So was this part of the story that surprised you when you, you know, have been encountering these stories over the years?
Maybe at first, but I've been encountering these stories for, you know, something like 25 years. Now I'm all too, you know, this is what I expect to find is people behaving badly. Not everybody, thank God. But,
yeah, a lot of people.
You know, there's still some hope, but yeah. And a lot of the structures are just so bad. You know, it's funny, in England, bartending was a women's profession, mixing the drinks and serving them. It comes to America, and here, because we don't have as many other old social institutions and guilds and other, you know, all kinds of ways for people to get together, bars take an outsized importance in early America. And suddenly the women are no longer behind the bar and the men have stepped into the spotlight because money was to be made. And, you know, it was like, oh, this is a profession that gives me a little status. Yeah. And so they immediately took over. And there's a lot of stuff like that. You know, the story of African-American bartenders is full of things that just make you gnash your teeth. They were some of the earliest and some of the best bartenders in the initial age of the American drink, of the American bar, you know, from the late 1700s up until, say, the Civil War. And afterwards, they are cut out from the bar and demoted, and they really are sent to only work in bars that serve their own community. And that lasts until the 1960s. And it's really kind of shocking because these were some of America's best bartenders.
And probably some of the unnamed authors of some of the cocktails that are written down.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So.
Yeah,
there were still pockets in clubland, so to speak, in private members' clubs. They still had a number of black bartenders, and some who the first two to write write cocktail books were club bartenders.
Mm. I want to talk barware because there's a variety of glasses that are tied to different drinks. We have coupes and highballs mm-hmm. and rock glasses. And are these culturally influenced or aesthetic, or do the shapes make a difference in how you experience the drink? Do we really need to have all these different glasses?
Well, you don't need to, but they do have their uses. You drink cocktails, up cocktails, ones that are stirred and strained or shaken and strained, from a stemmed glass because you don't want the bowl of the glass to get warm. So you hold it down with the stem. You don't cup it in your hand. Rocks glasses, you've got ice in the glass, so the glass isn't going to get warm, so you can just hold that. Highball glasses are tall and narrow because you're putting carbonation in there and you want to limit the surface area to keep the bubbles longer. There are reasons for some of this, but some of the stuff is definitely culturally determined. The iconic martini glass didn't exist. Well, people always drank out of conical glasses in one way or another, but the real like wide, shallow cone with the narrow, narrow stem and just perfectly straight and unornamented and the little round base, that comes in because an Austrian architect designs a champagne glass like that for an art exhibition in France in 1927 or 28, where you're not allowed to enter things in traditional designs. And so Guy Hertel just says, okay, and streamlines this glass and makes a modern classic.
Something we all have in our homes today. When we find glasses like this archaeologically, it's almost sometimes stemware, but mainly like shot glasses and tumblers, probably because it's like thicker glass that survives more. But I'm just wondering how many other types of fancy drinkware goes unrecognized when it's broken. Especially the more fine stuff. Yeah. What about tiki drinks? So those not only are kind of their own suite of cocktail, but they have a very distinctive glassware or ceramicware, I guess.
Yeah, and that came in mostly in the 1950s. Once there was a plethora of tiki bars, they sought ways to differentiate themselves from each other. And so one of the ways was custom glassware. And so every bar went out and got a whole bunch of mugs made. And, you know, people now collect these, and I've seen enormous collections of these things. They're all very colorful and fun.
Yeah, they're super fun.
and that was the golden age of you know, the tiki bar was a real part of mainstream America. I mean, Richard Nixon used to like to go to Trader Vic's.
Well, and it's funny because now, you know, the new kind of hipster tiki bars, I was in one in New York recently, and I was served a piña colada in a can, like an actual can that the coconut milk came in. So they're deconstructing, you know, kind of, it still had sprigs of everything and was delicious, but it wasn't in kind of the fancy glassware.
Yeah, they're again, you know, trying to differentiate themselves.
Yeah. And that kind of just reminds me too, what I was thinking about when, you know, I'm sure that my cocktail journey has been heavily influenced by you, but you know, when I first got into cocktails, I made my own grenadine and tonic and triple sec, but lately I've just been, you know, going back to the classics, a dry martini, or the best cocktail I've had in years was a daiquiri in a Berlin speakeasy. And it wasn't, of course, the goofy blended kind. It was just lime, rum, and sugar. And it just, like, going back, I think, to the simple few ingredients just done really, really well. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing that as a trend, a larger trend?
I'm seeing people starting to back off and roll back a little bit the sort of hyper foodie complex, we make all of our own ingredients mixology of the last few years, which, you know, can be a little bit of a dead end. Those are drinks that nobody else is going to make because they can't, and they're too complicated, and the ingredients are just too rare, too recherché. But I think some people are getting a little tired of those and are starting to appreciate just a more classic approach, maybe with a few twists here and there and a little bit of cleverness in the ingredients, but not heavily worked, you know, just more. I think in tough times, you want things that are a little more comforting, and maybe a little bit of back to basics is not the worst thing.
Yeah, that's definitely where I've just been going. But I wanted to end this interview by asking you what your favorite drink is, but I know that that's too contextual to give a general answer. So instead, I want to ask, what drink do you order when you're in a new bar and want to test their mettle? Because this is something I struggle with. What should I order if I'm not sure what I'm going to get?
If I want to see how good they are at paying attention to details and cocktails, I'll often order a New York sour, which is a whiskey sour with rye.
And the wine float, right?
Yep. A red wine float on top. And, now a lot of people put egg white in it and do it on the rocks, but originally it was straight up and no egg white, just so you get this beautiful layer of bright red wine capping off the sour, and they put it on the bar, and people down the bar start saying, "Hey, I want one of those."
And I so want next what he's thing having. You
know, yeah, exactly. So it's a beautiful drink and a striking drink. And if I think I don't like to test bars so much, if I think they can make it, I'll order that. If I think they probably would have a little bit of a struggle with that, I'm just going to have a dry martini, and then I'll see where I go after that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. This is good pro advice to follow. Thank you so much for joining me today on this episode of Underground History. This was so fun and interesting, and I just really appreciate hearing everything that you have to say.
Well, my great pleasure. This is fun stuff to talk about. It certainly better be.
Yeah, that's right.
And
even
thank
sober,
you so much for having
right?
me.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Even sober.
Well, that wraps up this spirited discussion on Underground History. Be sure to pick up the comic book history of the cocktail at your favorite local bookstore. Cheers from your host, Chelsea Rose, and my show producer, Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.